things that are new. So you think of whatever that means to you. Could be an approach to your life. It could be a new idea. It could be a new invention. It could be a new way of doing things. It could be a new direction or vision. You'll always find people. You'll find some who are skeptics. You'll find those who tend to reject anything that's different from the norm. There's an article that is printed many, many years ago, and it was entitled The Seven Last Words of a Dying Church. You know what those seven words are? We've never done it that way before. Skeptics. There's those people who are late adapters. You know, they need time to adapt. They need more research. They need more evidence. There are those people who are early adapters. You know, it comes quick to them. They get on board quicker. And then there's those that I think, you know, they're just ready. I think they've been prepared. They've been anxious for something new to take place. So they're on board the moment it is communicated. That applies into the world, that applies to the church, that applies to our faith, that applies to things that we're going to talk about today. You see, when we think about miracles, we've got skeptics. And the skeptic will look for loopholes, for rationale, to explain it away, for logic, to deny what took place. The skeptic will say, miracles don't take place anymore. They were reserved for the times of the Bible. Skeptics. You've got late adapters. They need more evidence. They're a little bit suspicious. They come in cautiously. But along the way, they come to a point where they move from caution to belief. And they begin to believe in the miracles that take place. You've got your early adapters. You know, their belief chain, or their belief in miracles quickly moves from caution to reality. And then there's some of us that just simply believe. What says in the Word of God, we take it, right? Face value, right off the top. If someone shares a testimony that God has done something in their life that's miraculous, we embrace it and we praise God for it immediately. I think that's the same today as it was in the Bible times. It definitely was true when Jesus was on planet Earth. We've talked about it in previous messages of always there's a crowd of the skeptic or the late adapters or the early adapters or those that embrace. All of us here today, everybody who's going to hear this message falls into one of those areas or one of those camps. So you're either a skeptic this morning or you're a late adapter or you're an early adapter. Or you're on board right from the get-go that miracles take place today. So we're going to continue through this series. Again, just to remind you, in the end of June, I talked about this idea of being at wit's end. It comes out of Psalm 107. And I felt the impression of God to say, okay, let's go beyond wit's end and let's take a few weeks and talk about what takes place when we're at wit's end and then we encounter Jesus Christ. And what changes? That's the sole purpose of the messages that we're preaching through the month of August. So we come to a miracle that is the last one that Jesus performs before he goes to the cross. But before we get there, I want us to turn back the pages of scriptures, and I want us to do a little bit of tour through the Old and New Testament. So I would encourage you, because we don't have time, because your favorite seat at the restaurant will get taken up if I read all these accounts in full. Some of them are lengthy. So what you're going to have to do is take out a pen, take out your sermon notes, if I think you got one in your bulletin. Jot down these scriptures, because I would encourage you to read the full accounts of each one of these, especially if you're a skeptic or a late adapter or even an early adapter, or even if you just believe. It's good to read them. So I'm just going to give you a real quick through it. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 22, where we're going to read. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child, carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, "Look, Your son is alive. And so the Old Testament records to us that Elijah raised a boy from death to life. 2 Kings 4, we're going to start at verse 32. Elisha now reached the house. There was a boy lying dead on his couch. He went in, he shut the door on the two of them, and he prayed to the Lord. Then he got on the bed and he lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands, and he stretched himself out upon him, and the boy's body began to warm. Dead bodies do not warm. Elisha turned away and he walked back and forth in the room, and then he got back into bed and he stretched out upon him once more. And the boy sneezed 7 times and he opened his eyes. Elisha raised a boy from death to life. This one is interesting. 2 Kings 13, starting at verse 20. About Elisha. Elisha died and was buried. Now Moabite raiders used to enter the country every spring. Once, while some Israelites were burying a man, suddenly they saw a band of raiders, so they threw the man's body into Elijah's tomb. When the body touched Elisha's bones, the man came back to life and he stood up upon his feet. Even Elisha's bones raises the dead. Yes. Acts chapter 9, verse 40. Peter sent them all out of the room. Then he got down on his knees and he prayed. Turning towards a dead woman, he said, "Tabitha, get up." She opened her eyes and seeing Peter sat up, he took her by the hand and helped her to her feet. Peter raised Tabitha from dead to life. Acts 20, verse 9. Seated in the window was a young man who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. I won't do that this morning, I hope. Don't sit by the windows, folks. Don't sit on the edge of the balcony. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, put his arms around him. "Don't be alarmed," he said, "friends. He's alive." Paul raised what was dead back to life. And on he preached. Gospels. Luke chapter 7, starting in verse 11. As he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Jesus went up to the coffin, and those carrying it stood still, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up and began to talk. Dead people don't talk. They don't sit up, friends. And Jesus gave him back to his mother. Jesus raised him from death to life. Luke chapter 8, verse 52 and onwards. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She's not dead but asleep." And they laughed at him, knowing full well she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned at once, she stood up. So Jesus raises Jairus' daughter from death to life. So what we're going to talk about today is not a one-off miracle, okay? If it was one-off, it's great. But the Old and New Testaments tell us this is not a one-time deal because God's in the business of raising the dead. So we come to Luke chapter 11, and there's 44 verses, which I'm not going to take the time to read. I'm going to encourage you to read them later. But we arrive at the last miracle, like I've said. Jesus is going to go into Jerusalem and face the cross. And so we meet a man named Lazarus. And Lazarus has been very, very ill, and he is not getting better. They've taken them to doctors. They've taken them to specialists. They've done all the tests. They've taken all the blood work. They can't find out what's wrong. And Lazarus is not getting better. He's just getting worse and worse and worse until a point in Lazarus' life where it ends and he dies. Lazarus comes from a very tight family. He has two sisters, Martha and Mary, and they're very close. This is a family where Jesus finds true friends. Jesus stays with them whenever he's going through to Jerusalem. It's Jesus' spiritual hangout when he needs space to talk with people because they're like-minded. They're mutual in spiritual friendship. And so what's clear to us in scriptures is that Lazarus and Mary and Martha are cherished friends of Jesus. So it would make sense to us that Martha and Mary would send someone to go find Jesus and tell him that Lazarus is getting worse. This is not good. We don't know what to do. But they know who Jesus Christ is. They recognize quickly that he's their only hope for Lazarus. And so they reach out to the one who could heal Lazarus and restore him back to health and strength. So news comes to Jesus. You can sense the urgency in the message. This is life and death now. There's a desperate cry from this family to come, Jesus, come help us. And given that reality, one would think that Jesus would quickly move towards Lazarus to heal him. But behind the curtains of heaven, there is a deeper play at work. And it's going to take time to set the scene. And to be honest, what the scene needs is a corpse for this to play out. Lazarus is the corpse. And so Jesus stays where he's at for two more days. He lingers. The turmoil comes for Martha and Mary because they can't see backstage in heaven. For them, all they see is the dark black curtain stretched out in front of their lives. All they can see is emptiness and helpless and hopelessness as Lazarus has now gone from life to death. And 4 days go by. Lazarus is already well into the tomb. But grief for this family, for these sisters, is no less. They've cried every tear that they can cry, and yet tears simply keep on coming. What they're about to experience in this day is they're going to come to a far deeper truth of just who Jesus Christ really is. Because in the midst of their tragedy, in the midst of their heartache, they're going to come to understand that Jesus Christ really is the Lord of life. They're going to discover that Jesus is not bound by time and space. They're going to recognize that death and disease are no threat to Jesus Christ. And so Jesus arrives in Bethany. And there's a very significant truth that begins to pull back those dark curtains in Martha and Mary's life. And they start moving from hopelessness to strength, and weakness to strength, hope to strength. Martha runs out to meet Jesus, and as they're dialoguing, Jesus turns to Martha and he looks her in the eyes and said, "Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die." Martha, do you believe this? Do you believe it? Do you believe in the resurrection of life through Jesus Christ? So we come to a tomb. And we come to a tomb with a big stone rolled across it. And that stone is simply protecting the precious body of Lazarus. Jesus is deeply moved. I think they say this is the shortest verse in the Bible. Don't miss the shortest verse in the Bible because it carries a punch. Jesus is deeply moved, and what does he do at the tomb? He joins in the grief. And he weeps. He weeps for a brother that he loved who's now dead. I think he weeps because Satan roams the earth trying to kill, steal, and destroy us. But that's not where it ends, is it? Jesus doesn't give some benediction over the graveside. He doesn't turn back to Martha and Mary and then go to console them. He doesn't lead a procession away from the tomb as if in some final act to bring closure to the death of Lazarus. That's not what Jesus does. He does none of those things because he is Jesus Christ. He's the Son of God. He has the power over life and death. And death has no power over Lazarus. And so what does Jesus do? He commands the guys around the tomb to roll back the stone. Pull it back, boys. Take it away. You don't need a stone any longer. And as that black curtain, as that curtain that's hiding heaven begins to be removed, Jesus calls out and he says, Lazarus, Lazarus, come out. And it was in those moments that Martha and Mary see the fullness of God's plan for Lazarus that they could not see in days earlier. They understood that the final act was not a death in a tomb, but it was restoration and it was healing and it was life. A little sidebar. I pondered this many times. You're smarter than me, I get that. But humor me. Why did he call Lazarus? Why did not Jesus say, come out? Come out. Do you know why Jesus never did that? Do you know why he called Lazarus out? Because I believe the whole graveyard would have come back to life again. He is the power over death. And there would have been people all over the place who were once dead, who are now alive and well, if he would have just simply said, come out. So you can be a skeptic, you can be a late adapter, early adapter, or believe that, take it as you will. I believe that that's the case, because Jesus is powerful, more powerful than death. There is nothing within death's grip that is able to hold back a graveyard when Jesus calls it out. My goodness, if Elijah's bones can raise people to life. Heaven's plan for this day was that Lazarus come out and to return to life so that God could be glorified and bring praise to the Father. A life would be restored. And the scriptures record to us that people's hearts were turned to God. And so we come to the conclusion of this in verse 44 of Luke 11. The dead man did what? He came out. His hands and his feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth over his face. And Jesus says to them, take off the grave clothes. Let him go. Who needs grave clothes when you're alive? You don't need them. So for us, I don't know where you're at entirely, but if you're dealing with tragedy, if you're dealing with loss, with pain, with heartache, with trials, whatever you're facing, you got to lean into this truth. You got to lean into it and apply it to your life. Because I want you to hear already the echoes off of the Apostle Paul's pen as he writes to the Corinthian church years after this account. What does Paul write? Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? Show me. Where is it? Because it doesn't exist when Jesus Christ is involved. Thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's a truth that Paul penned years after this account. It's the same for us today. These are truths that we got to hang on to. We have to embrace as we face our times of wit's end. So what I want us to do now is I want us to fast forward from Lazarus. I'm going to say several months ago, I think it was maybe around Easter. I'm not entirely sure of the whole timeline. But there's a man named Robert Morris. He's a senior pastor of Gateway Church, I think Southlake, Texas, down in Texas somewhere, who became very, very ill like Lazarus. His wife and him are away at a very remote location. No computers, from what I remember, no cell phones. I think they have a landline. They go there to rest. They go there where he can write. And what I'm going to ask you to do today is to write this down. Because I want you to take 40 minutes out of your week, out of this day, whenever. I want you to sit down with your